parallel.
Yes, there is some parallel there. It's not a perfect parallel because obviously these experiences are not directly a realization of God. There's an intimation of something transcendental, but it's not a full understanding, and that's the great blessing that we have. So yes, we're lucky. We're the lucky ones. You know, we have a real understanding of where all of this comes from. Yeah. Beautiful. And of course, you've been in Krishna consciousness more than 10 years. It's possible to, you know, reach this state in a shorter period of time. But generally, the general rule seems to be that, you know, for example, let's say a jazz pianist, right, is playing. When Bill Evans is playing piano, I'm a big fan of Bill Evans. He's not thinking, okay, let's say I'm going to play this chord, then I'm going to put my little finger here, and then I'm going to play that note. All of that stuff is happening quite spontaneously. There's no conscious thought of it. All of that's second nature. And his heart and his mind are free to experiment with ideas and go in new directions and try breaking boundaries and, you know, being spontaneous. So 10 years in order to master the skills so that you can then become spontaneous in your devotional service. So first you begin by mastering the basics, and then you can begin to take wing and experiment with your devotional life. Yes.
So I was thinking that oftentimes during book distribution, they would talk about the samadhi of book distribution, when you could just feel Krishna. It wasn't like you were doing it, it was like Krishna was working through mm-hmm. you, and it was just happening totally effortlessly, yeah. And you felt like nimittamatma, you felt like mm-hmm. Krishna was using you as an instrument. And whatever service devotees do, if you chant really good rounds, sincere rounds, then you get that same feeling, whatever you're doing, that's really, it's Krishna doing it, mm-hmm. he's working through you, so.
Yeah, exactly. So you got it. You know, there are these parallels here, that at a certain point, we're just vehicles for Krishna's will, you know, what he wants to have happen in the world. We will do our little bit to help, you know, and when we use the word surrender, you know, when we're surrendered to that, which I think is another way of saying when we lose selfish motives for doing something, when it's really, truly, purely, I just want to please you, you know, my dear Lord, my dear Srila Prabhupada, I just want to do this for your satisfaction. And things start happening through you without having to force it. You know, there's something natural that begins to take place at that moment. So it's fascinating, isn't it, to see how the mystics have intimations of that moment in devotional service.
So then what would the actual definition be of mysticism?
Well, you know, mysticism is, you know, from the Greek, mystos, which simply means mystery. You know, it's the search for the mystery of life, the meaning of life. Mm. And we're all on a path back to Krishna, you know, one form or another. And certain souls who are close to that, there are these moments of breakthrough. You know, these moments when the clouds part and something becomes crystal clear. If you hear how devotees came to Krishna consciousness, very often it's a mystic experience. I remember one devotee named Hanuman, who's from Canada, who was, this is back in the mid-60s, you know, 65, 66, no, it must have been 67. Okay, so he was meditating in the mountain caves of Mexico, totally naked, you know, just, my dear Lord, you know, just like, show me a sign, you know, and the lightning was flashing, and it was a big stormy night, and he decided, I've got to get out of this cave, and he put on some clothes and went down the hillside, and he started hitching, and the first car that picked him up drove him all the way to San Francisco and left him outside the temple door. It's like, whoop, you know. There's one devotee in France. He told me this personally. So I asked him, how did you come to Krishna consciousness? He said, well, you know, Prabhu, when I was always feeling very sad, I used to go to the lake. I was fishing, you know, in the lake. I have a little boat. So I go fishing. And so describing, he threw out his line saying, "Oh, dear Lord, you know, give me some sign." And he feels a tug on the line. And he reels it in. And there on the hook of his fishing line in a watertight plastic wrapper was Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. You know? These things happen very, very unusual, strange ways, you know. And people come to Krishna consciousness in miraculous ways, mystical ways.
Sounds like mysticism is like a little bit of Krishna's mercy.
It's a little bit, it's a little taste.
Pours it out.
That's right, it's a little taste of what Krishna can do. You know? Yeah. And so we need to be maybe sensitive to the fact that people come to God, right, in different ways. And they don't always have this epiphany of, you know, Radha and Krishna and Vrindavan. You know, that's a very particular kind of imagery of the spiritual world. And if people are in other traditions, they may not have that particular imagery. It doesn't mean that they're cut off from God or they're cut off from some breakthrough in their devotional life. So to be respectful of that, I think, is very important. I remember times with Prabhupada when he would be meeting with religionists, people from the Franciscan order or from different church groups and so on. And if they were sincere, it was the most beautiful thing. They were, like, Prabhupada would be communing with them. You know, they would just be swapping these beautiful stories about God. Just the most wonderful thing to see. You know, he was not sectarian about God consciousness.
Yogeshwar Prabhu, where does this? I was surprised to hear you describe mysticism in such sort of almost mundane terms, because I tend to think of mysticism as some wild, you know, completely disorientating type. Where does that come from? Why do we? And why do I have that conception of mysticism as opposed to a more...
We have a kind of negative impression of mystical experiences because science tends to denigrate mystic experience as some kind of like brain seizure. You know, some kind of biochemical imbalance in the, you know, cerebellum or something. You know, and to be... treated, people who have mystic experiences should be treated with psychotropic drugs, you know, so they can come down off of these wild ideas that they're having and, you know, calm down. The general, there's a fear of it. There's a fear of people who have had these experiences because many of them are pretenders. Many people pretend to have mystic experiences and then go and do harm to people. So there's a lot of suspicion about mystic experiences. They don't seem very scientific. You know, they defy scientific explanation. You can't give them... The only way you can medically describe, you know, a mystic experience is by denigrating it, you know, into some imbalance, a chemical imbalance. So generally we would have a negative image of what mystic experience is like.
And just one other question. After the peak experience, as you said, maintaining it becomes the issue. How do we maintain it? How do we not be fallen from that mystical experience once we've reached a peak state?
Well, there's the peak experience, and then there's the steady state of devotional life, right? So peak experience, you couldn't live in peak experience all day long. You'd die. It's like, you know, and it's said that, you know, the great Uttama Adhikara, they come down, don't they? You can't live in that ecstatic experience all the time to get practical things done. in the world. So even people who have that, you know, I think of the story of Rock Talk and Nectar of Devotion. You know, he's fanning Krishna. He's having these ecstatic things. He's just, calm down, calm down. You know, I can't do my service if I'm just having these ecstatic peripolations. So he's calming himself down. Those moments are gifts. You know, those breakthrough moments are incentives. They're like going on pilgrimage or something. You know, it's a break from the ordinary world to, as an encouragement, it's a gift from God to encourage us to go on with the steady state of devotional life. And then when we become proficient in Krishna consciousness and our devotional service, there's a joy, you know, there's a steady sense of joy that never goes away. You know, that's what those verses are in Bhagavad Gita. You know, you reach a place where you're always joyful. No matter how difficult the circumstances around you, you know, I am spirit soul, I am protected by Krishna, my spiritual master is here protecting me, I have nothing to worry about. And no matter how hard it gets, such a person in devotional life is very steady, very, very steady.
Thank you.
Very nice class. 11th canto, 15th chapter, third verse onward. It explains that all this mystic that you have explained, experienced by the materialistic, is actually not original mystics. Original mystics, Prabhupada in Nectar Devotion says, 8 mystic siddhi, it is originally lies in Krishna's body. Then it extends further 5, total 23, but the rest 5 that mostly experience here, created by Maya Dana and Maya material creation. It's a reflection of the original pleasure, not real pleasure. That's why it's flickering. In the spiritual world, because at the end or the last one in the Prabhupada's translation, he said, okay, those mystic experience, happiness, it actually keeps them away from the contact of material nature. But our situation, not only interested to get out of Maya, we are not interested so much to get out of Maya, we are interested to relink, reform our devotional service attitude. Mm-hmm. So then automatically, otherwise just experiencing this mystic siddhi, it will not let the soul's ultimate satisfaction. Even though you brought that sixth canto, and sixth chapter, that Jamlabdha Chaparam Lavam, that there is no more higher than that, they feel. Yes, Prabhupada quote that, I remember many times. But that applicable only for this level mystics. But I don't see as a devotee, Sevananda, Prabhupada said there is a 3 pleasure, right? Sevananda, Brahmananda and Jarananda. But Sevananda is uninterrupted. The pleasure is uninterrupted. In Brajavasi, all the Vaikundavasi, their happiness, there is never need to come down or anything. They are always 24 hours transcendentally blissful. Never a chance there can be absence of pleasure. Even in the separation, this is another ecstatic form of pleasure.
Yes, you've spoken very nicely. That's exactly correct. Bear in mind that what I presented just now was how I might speak to a university group or in a yoga studio group so that there's some point of entry for them so that they can get to the place that you're describing, which is a wonderful higher realization of the ecstasy of devotional life. So thank you. That's a very good explanation. Stithadi?
Yeah, I was going to add something to the mysticism discussion. To be, as with everything, you can complicate it. You know, there's also been a tradition in the West with the Catholic Church emphasizing miracles as proof of divinity. So suddenly mysticism is somehow separate from ordinary experiences like this duality. And so suddenly whenever you talk about something non-empirical, you get into a conversation. You know, I mean, I would assume from an Eastern perspective, it's more all of one same comprehensive experience. Some of it may be ordinary, some of it may be a little extraordinary, but there isn't that sharp dichotomy. So then when you're talking in a modern intellectual situation, and especially with science, where they only deal with what they can allegedly empirically manipulate, it's just this other realm that's full of, you know, it's just this big other that is loaded with baggage. So, you know, we've inherited a lot of baggage about this mysticism stuff.
What's fascinating, yeah, you're absolutely right. What's fascinating is that there's a small but growing community of scientists also who are beginning to realize that there's something else going on here. There are too many holes in our research. You know, there are too many unanswered questions. There's some greater mystery going on, and they're also becoming a little bit more open. So that's an encouraging sign. Thank you. I don't know what time this class ends, but maybe if there's one more, maybe time for one more question or something.
I just think that both Narada Muni and Dhruva were good examples of personalities who had a mystical experience.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then, you know, Krishna even spoke to Narada, you see me now, but you're not going to. So he just went on with his devotional activities, mm-hmm. which is, I think all devotees have had some kind of, you know, mystical experience. Mm-hmm. But then we just continue with our chanting and our serving and knowing that there's one verse in Bhagavad Gita, it's so beautiful. No, actually it's in Bhagavatam. It just talks about the unbroken joy that you experience, you know, when you finally see the Lord. No inebriety, you know, it's just unbroken. That we can't compare it to any kind of pleasure in the material world. There's always an end to it. Unbroken, spontaneous. It's so beautiful. I don't know if anyone knows where that verse is.
Beautiful. Thank you. So if there's a takeaway from this, I guess for us, it would be don't give up hope. don't allow the occasional miseries and setbacks of life in the material world to compromise your commitment to your devotional life. You're not alone. We have all kinds of people helping us, you know, who are, they may be unseen, but they're there. You know, Prabhupada is there, our spiritual master is there, Krishna is there, Suprasol is there. And those moments do happen when you will experience something out of the ordinary that will serve as an impetus for you to carry on. So, yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.